Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI, staff, volunteers, management, or sponsors. And this is Sharon Lockhart. Welcome to Every Woman, another edition. And take it away, women.
This is Amy Bell. We're here with Ebony Johnson, who's taking over the engineering today, and Beth Wilkinson, who is going to soon be doing the board herself. And our guests today are Rosemarie Woods, who's on the phone with us, and Jane McLean is in the studio. They're joining us to talk again about the Wall of Women's Achievement, which is a 10-panel photo montage that chronicles American women's journey since winning the vote in 1920. There's over 400 women from the fields of art, business, politics, religion, science, sports, and technology. There's diverse faces of women from various social economic groups and walks of life. It's a visual rehearsal of the invaluable contributions women have made to the life of our country as we strive towards full equality, which is a very lovely concept. I'm loving the sound of this wall. But Rosemarie, I believe we are going to start with you.
News.
The news.
Oh,
this is usually Sharon's job.
We'll have a bit of news, and then we'll come back with discussing the Wall of Women. Revolution in the Making, Abstract Sculpture by Women, 1947 to 2016, on display March 13th through September 4th, looks at the largely unaccredited role that female sculptors have played in recent art history. The show inaugurates the Los Angeles Gallery, Hauser Wirth, and Schimmel, and introduces co-curator Paul Schimmel in the role of gallerist. On view are works by 100 female artists. The craft elements that originally marginalized many women are commonly used by artists today. Women, says co-curator Jenny Sorkin, have been at the helm all along. W Magazine reported March 10th. Airlines are looking to diversify their pilot corps, but women still make up only a fraction of the applicants. In the U.S., women make up only about 6.5% of all pilots. But on one San Francisco to Maui United Airlines flight, the pilots, flight attendants, gate attendants, and even some of the ground crew are all women, a rare occurrence in the male-dominated world of aviation. I never thought it would be like this, but it's really wonderful that it is, said United Airlines Captain Wanda Collins. Studies like from 2006 found that in aviation, masculine beliefs, values, and perceptions appear to continue to dominate the industry and has led to female pilots experiencing sexism, discrimination, prejudice, hostility, and inappropriate discourse. Sometimes it's hard because you feel like nobody takes you serious, but for as many times as you get that feeling, you also get the feeling of people looking at you and they're inspired by you, Collins said. CBS News reported March 11th.
And we're back. I think Rosemarie Woods is on the telephone with us. Is that correct, Rosemarie?
That is correct. Thank you all so much. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about Helen Keller and the part of her that most people don't know. But while I was listening to the news about, you know, the airlines and women pilots, it made me think of the Mercury 13. Do you know about the Mercury 13?
No.
No.
The Mercury 13 were 13 women who were pilots during World War One, who were selected for training for the astronaut program.
Did you say World War One?
I mean World War Two. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, even during World War Two, what astronaut program?
The Mercury program. the first men in space, or the first people in space.
Well, they were men.
Well, they were men. But I didn't know about this until about 5 or 6 years ago. There was an exhibit over at UMKC. If you look up Mercury 13, you'll find out about these 13 awesome women, many of whom had more flight times than the original Mercury 7 astronauts. But they were totally, nobody heard about them.
That's not unusual now, is it?
Well, no, it isn't, but I think it's just a shame.
It is a shame.
That, you know, we had these women that were flying mostly cargo flights, you know, refueling and sending supplies to the soldiers fighting in World War II who were doing awesome work and putting their lives in danger and selected for the space program that nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah. Right, and when was it when Sally Ride was the first American woman in space?
You know, I hate to say this, but I would have to look it up. I don't remember.
I think it was either late 70s.
Early 80s,
early
maybe.
Early 80s.
Yeah. It was way after, and I can't remember the Russian woman's name who actually went up into space.
Right, and then it was just shortly after that the first African-American woman, Mae Jemison, who was also a medical doctor, was the first African-American woman in space.
Right, and these should be household names.
They really should. Well, back to Helen Keller.
Oh, I just wanted to share. I got to meet Sally Ride.
You did? Wow.
Yeah, that was a really great experience. Talk about meeting a strong woman. It was through the Girl Scouts. The Girl Scouts hosted Sally Ride for a luncheon, and we got to actually meet a real-life astronaut and the first woman to go to space, and it was just so incredibly inspiring. And that, to me, is why it's really important to recognize these women who've done these great things, because the opportunity to see that Sally Ride was a real person was the opportunity to see yourself being able to achieve that level of excellence.
Yeah, good point.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, congratulations. That's awesome. I'd be very proud of that myself. Can I just read you something?
Absolutely.
And then we can maybe have a little discussion. All right. Congress is not preparing to defend the people of the United States. It is planning to protect the capital of American speculators and investors. Incidentally, this preparation will benefit the manufacturers of munitions and war machines. Now, does that sound like something that could be said today?
Absolutely.
That was Helen Keller in January of 1916.
Wow.
Wow is right. I had no idea. It sounds very reminiscent of the, was it Eisenhower who warned against the military-industrial complex?
Right. But I will tell you and all the listeners, I found an article last April on the Internet. It's called The Radical Descent of Helen Keller. It was written in Yes Magazine, 18th of April, 2015. You can just search for The Radical Descent of Helen Keller. It'll show up, Yes Magazine. Please take the time to read it. This woman was a social activist.
She was inspirational.
I didn't know this, but she helped found the ACLU.
I feel like this is another example of the importance of women's history and what we get in the classroom as not being sufficient, because I do believe most of us probably learned about the miracle worker. I know a lot of classes go and see that play as a class, and it's told, and it is an inspiring story to a child with obstacles to overcome.
Right.
But then it ends there as though, well, she led a semi-normal life, and that was good enough for her. But she led an incredible life.
She really did. And even starting in the suffrage movement, she was with Alice Paul in the National Women's Party. She was right, if not picketing in front of the White House, she was right on the front lines speaking out for women's vote.
And, you know, a lot of that is privately funded, and that was like with the Mercury 13th, that was privately funded, and then they got to go into NASA, and then with Helen Keller, I mean, this wasn't something that they went for grants to get grants for. It was something that was organized and made function, made happen by private funding.
Right, and this is, I will interject, this is why Jane's Wall of Women's Achievement is so important, and it should visit every school in the greater Kansas City area.
Thank you. I will take this opportunity to say it's at the West Wyandotte Library in Kansas City, Kansas now, which is on 82nd Street between Parallel and State. It will be there for the rest of Women's History Month.
Good.
Well, can I... Helen Keller is just one of my absolute favorite women, American women in history. I was very excited that you were talking about this. And her founding of the ACLU, I would really love to talk about what she did for people with disabilities and what was said about her because of her disability and attacked for her disability as well.
She was attacked. I mean, she did a lot of work, obviously, for the blind and the deaf. But because of her social activism, and I tell you, it was Annie Sullivan's husband, John Macy, that really introduced her to a wide variety of political views, including communism and socialism. And one thing I found really just blew me away is she read a lot of socialist pamphlets in German Braille. She just didn't know English Braille. She read them in German Braille. That, to me, is just like, oh, I feel, you know, my scant knowledge of French makes me very humble.
I have scant knowledge of German and no knowledge of Braille and just completely...
Yeah, that just blew me away. But that introduced her to a lot of, you know, social movements. But one of the other quotes I found so gut-wrenching is she really got involved with labor movements and the poor. And she said, I've visited sweatshops, factories, crowded slums. If I could not see it, I could smell it. Mm. Now that's powerful because we who have all of our senses, we can see things, we can hear things, and we can smell things, but people who are one or two sensory deprived, their other senses are heightened. So I can't imagine what that woman was smelling.
Hmm. Well, and that was part of what I had read about her was that when she started saying scary things to the powers that be, she went from America's sweetheart to, well, let's not get too far. Obviously, she couldn't have gotten a real education being all disabled and everything.
But she graduated magna cum laude from Radcliffe.
Yeah, and they still managed to make it seem like that was just something that was kind of good for someone like her.
Right. Right. And this won't come as a surprise. And when I read it, I went, well, of course, that I didn't know that, but it makes sense. She was under FBI surveillance for most of her life because she backed labor unions, socialist causes, working people, poor people. She was a big proponent of women's suffrage, but also of birth control.
Mm, wow.
Yeah, she was friends with Margaret Sanger. And she evidently, Keller argued that capitalists want poor people to have large families so they can have cheap labor.
Mm.
And I'm like, whoa, man, this is just hitting too close to what's going on now. Not that I'm saying that's their motive, but it's not a far stretch, in my opinion.
It's the kind of conversations that can make all of us feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I think in our day and time now, we're understanding that the importance of having conversations, even if we feel uncomfortable about it, because you, that saying is true whether we like it or not. You can't resolve problems if you don't first acknowledge that there is one.
Exactly. And it's like if you look at the, for example, the Fight for 15 stand-up KC, mm-hmm. you know, yes, there are many, many men involved in that are working for absolutely horrible wages. But most of them are women, single mothers, and people of color. And that just needs to be acknowledged.
Yes. And with that, we're going to take a station break, and we will be back.
When you were a kid and got hurt, you'd go to your mother.
For TLC.
Someone to stand up for you.
Same goes now if you're hurt by a drunk driving crash. Just go to the Mothers.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
MAD for short. Call 877-MAD-HELP.
Help and no charge, of course.
Of course.
Learn more about how we help victims of drunk driving next time you visit at MAD.org.
This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's that time of year again. The KKFI band auction is coming, and we have condensed the auction into 4 days this year, Thursday, March 31st to Sunday, April 3rd. Listen, bid, win the band or solo artist for a two-hour show at your event. It's just that easy. Donations go to KKFI's general fund to keep us on the air. If you're a band or solo artist and want to get involved, KKFI is still taking submissions for this year's auction. Please check out kkfi.org/bandauction for all the details. And if you're a bidder and want to know who is playing and when, kkfi.org/bandauction will have the list of artists posted on Friday, March 18th. Thanks for supporting KKFI.
Rosemary, I was sitting here during the break thinking, why hasn't the feminist movement from the beginning embraced Helen Keller as part of their identity?
That's an awesome question, and I don't have an answer.
I think we need to fix this.
Well, you know, if I were to say my gut reaction to that, she was a socialist. And, you know, that has been a dirty word in this country for far too many decades. And I think that may have had something to do with why the feminist movement didn't do it.
Yeah, maybe I could break in here and say at the time, we're talking about the time in the early 20s. And when women had just gotten the vote, and just to come back, women were very strong for women at that time, but they were also faced with just being able to join in to the male political community. Now, when you were talking about Helen Keller, it made me think of Frances Perkins, who was the first labor secretary. But what you need to know is that Frances Perkins had a background and was contemporaneous with Helen Keller, and she first found out about the terrible working conditions when her college took her on a trip to a textile factory. And she saw what the children were doing. She went on and later, before women even got the vote, was working with the New York Consumers Union. And then another aspect in the history of women and labor and consciousness was when she was at a meeting of the Consumers Union and fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, and that's where all of these women, young women workers, mostly Jewish and Italian, were trapped. And Frances Perkins saw at least 47 of these women jump from the 8th or the 9th story to their deaths. In that fire, 146 people were killed, mostly young women. In fact, it was the worst workplace tragedy until September 11th, 2001, or otherwise 9/11. And this just struck Frances Perkins to the Corps. She later, and she was on the safety board that investigated the fire, but later she married. Her husband got sick. We think he was bipolar, and she ended up having to be the breadwinner for the family, as we say. And she kept on in labor relations. She had made friends, well, to make a long story short, the first time that women could vote in New York in 1918, she was for the man that got to be the governor of New York. He put her on the industrial board so that by the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt was governor of New York, she was the commissioner of labor. So when I was growing up, and in the history class where you have 5 minutes to tell about Frances Perkins, all you knew was that she was the first cabinet member and that she was the Secretary of Labor, and that Eleanor Roosevelt had suggested her for the job, that she was not only because she was woman, because she was the best person, man or woman, for the job. I never knew of her long 20-year history in labor and industrial relations, ending up being the commissioner of industrial relations for the whole state of New York before this. But here's where the story gets really good. When FDR called her in to offer her the job, she said that before she accepted, she had to know if he would support her ideas. She told him, "I don't want to say yes, and yes unless you know what I'd like to do and are willing to have me go ahead and try." Well, what she wanted to do was to solve some of the problems that she had seen. She wanted direct federal aid to the states for unemployment relief, public works for projects, wanted to establish maximum hours of work. She had gotten it down to 48 hours for women up to this point. Minimum wages, child labor laws, unemployment insurance, Social Security, and a revitalized public employment service. So she said, "Are you sure you want these things done?" And Roosevelt never hesitated, said, "Yes, I'll back you." Frances Perkins became the architect of the New Deal. Of course, she had to get it through Congress, but Roosevelt did back her, and by the time... That's why we have the National Labor Relations Act that protects workers and their right to organize. We have the Fair Labor Standards Act, minimum wage, 40-hour week, overtime pay, prohibiting child labor, and what most of them, people my age, the Social Security Act that protected people in their old age. Mm-hmm. Now, she didn't do this as a firebrand woman. She was 52 before she became a cabinet member. She wasn't particularly good-looking. Not bad, but not good.
The men stood behind her, though, was the thing. Because it was like she was fighting for their rights. And that didn't matter anything else, but they stood behind her.
And she was very clever. For all of her life, she had been keeping notes on her male colleagues, and she had it under in a folder under title on Notes on the Male Mind.
and could be a book.
Yeah. Well, anyway, she used these notes when she went into the cabinet. She said, "I knew that a later lady interposing an idea into men's conversation is very unwelcome. I just proceeded on the theory that this cabinet meeting was a gentleman's conversation on the porch of a golf club, perhaps. You didn't butt in with bright ideas." But she'd already had the president's promised to back her on these things, and later she got some of her bright ideas in, but she always dressed very matronly. Well, she was a matron. She was 52 in that. And it said she was the Secretary of Labor for 12 years, all during FDR's administration. When World War II broke out, she advocated against drafting women, which was up for a question, but that's so that more civilian women could get into the labor force and get more jobs. So in a way, women had to be really careful in that day and age, as they were moving into a very male-dominated era, to work the system, be twice as qualified for everything they did, and to keep notes on the male mind and act accordingly.
Do you think it's that different today?
Well,
how different is it today? Have you noticed that if it's a woman with an idea, it's not accepted very generally?
Well, yes, and you know, it falls over into the presidential race right
now.
You know,
you have to be almost a salesperson. I mean, you know what I mean? You almost have to be a salesperson to sell your ID and stand up for yourself and other women.
Well, the other thing that I'd like to note is that we have another socialist on our hands with Frances Perkins.
Yes.
This was the one great success of socialism that this country's really ever had was Frances Perkins's
getting the New Deal.
And I wonder if this was also influenced by thinkers like Helen Keller, who did stand up early on for socialism. And, of course, these are all women who stood up for socialism before the McCarthy era, before the Red Scare and that type of thing.
Well, yes, but you also have to realize that it was 1917 when the Russian Revolution. So these ideas were swimming around the world. And you had people like the International Workers of the World, the IWW, which were known as the Wobblies. There was a great Red Scare about 1919, right after World War I. And so socialism was much stronger, and probably the Depression and the New Deal was one of the reasons why we didn't go any further, but that was about as far as we could get in this country with those ideas.
Right. I agree with that. And I think that, you know, the political climate tends to seed different movements and different political ideologies. I mean, we can see that today, and we don't need to go into it because it'll probably raise my blood pressure even more. But there are people all over the political spectrum today who are legitimately angry and legitimately afraid of their future, of their kids' future, their grandkids. It's how all of this is being channeled and what scare tactics are being brought up. I mean, obviously, from what I've seen, Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism is not the hot potato it would have been 20 or 30 years ago.
No.
I mean, this is not an endorsement for or against, but just that particular issue, it is not the hot potato even 10 years ago that it could have been. I mean, we don't have the Soviet Union anymore. It is Russia. The Soviet Union collapsed.
Right, and we've gone into a whole different era of what we might call extremism on both sides.
Well, I kind of think we need to move on to the next woman that we want to talk about, and I think this is a good time because we're talking about working conditions and where we are now and what we still need to be doing. And this next woman was an absolute, she was kind of the lightning rod that took the brunt of this argument for us, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And we're talking about Lilly Ledbetter, jumping from just the groundwork that you could say Frances Perkins was able to lay. And then as things went on, it took until 1963 for the Equal Pay Act to pass. 1963. Well, now, part of the structure is that when these laws get passed, you don't have enough people to enforce them or to regulate them, and they just sort of get pushed back into the woodwork.
They get to pat themselves on the back about having done a good thing. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it has a good effect is another story.
That's right. So fast forward from 1963, and there are a lot of stories in between, but let's focus on Lilly Ledbetter. This is March of 1998. Lilly Ledbetter has been a worker at the Goodyear Tire Company in Gadsden, Alabama, for almost 20 years. She's an area manager on an overnight shift from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Little background, her initial salary was the same as men, but as they went along, the pay raises and bonuses were not the same. So she gets this note in March of 1998 that tells her that her salary at that time was not bad, $3,700 a month, but men in the same position were making $4,200 a month or even $5,200 a month. Well, that was a revelation to her, and she went in and filed a grievance. Because, you know, not only was this money that she was having to support her family with, this was going to go on to her retirement pay, which would be a proportion of her salary, as those of us who are sitting here retired know. Okay. So she went and filed an EEOC complaint, and what Goodyear did was to assign her to a job that required her to lift heavy tires, even though she was 60 years old, and they threatened to go so far as to put everybody out of a job at the Gadsden Goodyear plant and just close it because of what she had done. And they forced her into early retirement, with pay that was financially determined. Anyway, she filed a suit. She won a $3 million settlement. Well, of course, Goodyear took it to the appeals court where she lost. And away went the $3 million and found that there was no problem and with equal pay here. She took it to the Supreme Court. It was argued in 2006-2007. This is a terribly financially burdened journey for over almost 10 years. And the Supreme Court found in the appeals court favor. And so, now, do you need to stop because... Okay.
No, keep going.
Okay, keep going. Well, anyway, immediately, here's another woman comes in. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the dissenting opinion, which said, "In our view, the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be victims of pay discrimination. Title IV was meant to govern real work employment practices, and that world is what the court today ignores. The ball is in the Congress's court now." And only hours later, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton took up the call and introduced a bill into Congress to eliminate the statutory rule, which was that you had to go within 90 days of the first thing. The rule was that every paycheck was a new beginning. It took it till 2009 to be passed. It was the first law passed during the Obama administration.
Well, I want to thank you, Jane and Rosemarie, for joining us today. I really want to do some more of this. There's more women to talk about, and I love talking about women's history. And, boy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg got brought up, and she's a fantastic woman to tell some history about, too. Can we do that sometime?
Absolutely.
Sure. Thank you.
Could you give us one more time where the Wall of Women's Achievement is located right now?
Right now, it's located at the West Wyandotte Library in Kansas City, Kansas. And that's on 82nd Street there between State and Parallel.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us. We need to take a station break, and we're going to come back with DeSoto School Districts and healthy school lunches.
Hello, everybody. KKFI is presenting an evening with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! At All Souls UU Church on April 9th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. with a VIP dinner catered by Californos and includes a copy of her new book, Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. Followed at 7:30 by a talk about the book and her experience as a journalist in the last 20 years. Thanks to KCPT and Rainy Day Books for their help with this event. An evening with Amy Goodman on April 9th at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Tickets for both the VIP dinner and the talk are at kkfi.org/events. Thanks for supporting KKFI.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, political science Dr. Nathan Madden and magazine host Brian Nolan discuss the ongoing three-ring circus that we're calling the 2016 American presidential election. Why is Donald Trump so much like the blob? The more he's attacked, the stronger he gets. Tune in for a fun and lively discussion. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Today we have an interview by telephone with Amy Drogemeyer from U.S. School District 232 in DeSoto, Kansas, and she's going to talk to us about something that she's been advocating for some time, and that's healthy food for kids in schools. Welcome, Amy, to Every Woman.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And so how long have you been involved in this project, and just tell us about your experience.
Sure. I have been in this position for 5 years. This is my fifth year of working in school food service. I'm also a mom, which puts it very near and dear to my heart. I have two boys who I'm watching grow up and trying to help them make better choices and the lifestyles that they live with being active and eating right. So it's kind of like my 7,000 kids in my district. I get to be the mom to them as well and really just help them understand why they need to make good choices. Not necessarily that they need it right now as a teenager because they're very active, but really that they're creating these habits that they're going to carry with them the rest of their lives, and that will affect their health the rest of their lives in their 40s and 50s and 60s and even in their 30s. So that's something I'm very passionate about, is making sure that we set them up for success.
So then in your capacity, you plan the menus for the school lunches?
Yes, ma'am, I do. I plan the menus. We decide what items we're going to sell as a la carte at our secondary levels. And all of the other collaboration that we are doing with our teachers in the classrooms or projects or parent groups, really trying to make this a community-based effort.
I remember some years ago having some friends who were very upset because of the coin-operated pop machines in the schools. Is that still an issue?
It's not. Actually, the part of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was to provide us guidance on what kinds of items can be sold on school campuses during the school day. And so last school year, those rules went into effect, and it not only affects the items that are sold in our cafeterias, but also the items that are sold in our vending machines or our school stores or fundraisers, really to try to create a healthy environment overall and not just in the cafeteria. So soda is not allowed to be sold in schools during the school day. Now, there may still be machines, but they are to be turned off during the school day and can be only available like in the evenings if districts even choose to have them. Our district doesn't have soda machines even available to students at any point on our campuses.
And this is Ebony. What has been your response as far as the students and the parents with the changes that have been made?
Well, with anything, change is hard. And so we really just try to advocate with the teachers and the parents to help them make those changes at home, but also to let the kids try new things, make it a risk-free environment where they can try something and maybe they don't like it, and that's okay, letting them know that as long as you try it, that's the most important thing. And just letting them experiment, try new menu items, try new fruits, try new vegetables. One of the things that's been kind of a cult hit in our district is we do tropical fruits in February. We focused on that. And so we've brought in kumquats, which you don't typically find in the store in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And so we have several of our students that love when we finally offer that because it's something that they haven't had the opportunity to have before. And mm-hmm. we're able to do that with other things throughout the school year. It really just helps us listen to our students. That's the most important thing we can do is mm-hmm. listen to, you know, what are they eating outside of here and maybe giving them a little bit healthier option and showing them how they can also do that at home. Also, I do work in the classrooms where I meet with students and let them know, you know, what they can get outside of here and how it compares to a school lunch or how what they're eating at home. And that's really in collaboration with our health teachers and those mm-hmm. partnerships.
I can imagine how it can create a conversation about food in a way that we may not have been used to having. Not that some people aren't, but predominantly, I guess, in our current cultural climate, where just being more exploratory with food options and how the cycles and the seasons change and what fruits ripen in what seasons. And like you said, even having the kumquats being something that students can say, oh, well, what is this? And so that kind of creates maybe some insightfulness as to, oh, there are a lot of other things that maybe I don't know about food, you know, for the children. And then when they Absolutely. Go home, entertain that conversation with their parents, which, you know, can affect their family dynamic as well.
It does. And some of the things we try to utilize are positive peer pressure. So mm-hmm. instead of a kid saying, ooh, yuck, broccoli, you might have a kid saying, ooh, I love broccoli. And mm-hmm. then the next four kids in line will choose that as well. Maybe it's not something they've ever tasted before, or maybe it's not something that they've ever considered tasting before. But when we use that positive peer pressure with, especially at the high school level, our student athletes who are learning what they put in their bodies actually affects their performance on the field, mm-hmm. we're using some of those more popular students to help us model healthy eating, as well mm-hmm. as our teachers. We have a lot of teachers that also do that at the elementary level, modeling that for our students so that, it makes it okay for them to want to try something new mm-hmm. and eat healthy. And it's not necessarily about a political stance or about mm-hmm. A social stance or anything like that. It's just food, and we're doing what's right for our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Does eating healthy cost more money?
It does, and it can. We definitely spend more in fruits and vegetables in our district than the average district, but we feel like that's an investment that we're making and a commitment we're making to our kids. We use that as a way to encourage them to participate and show them that, hey, it's more than just the standard school lunch that maybe your parents grew up with, where you only had one vegetable to choose from. We offer them at least 6 or 7 different fruits and vegetables every day, some most fresh, some canned, some frozen, and let them experience those things. And yes, it does cost more, but we see the benefits are more than just financial in making sure that our kids are healthier, and then we won't have as many health care costs and those kinds of things as we move forward as a society.
Now, we got connected with you through an email press release from the Pew Charitable Foundation, and you're working with them and also the Robert Wood Foundation. How did you get connected with them, and how has that worked out?
I think we've been connected through our State Department of Education. We have our Child Nutrition and Wellness team, and the work that we've been doing locally has been recognized at the state level, and then that information was then shared with Pew Charitable Trust and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And we've been asked to come and partner with them and advocate on Capitol Hill and with other partners throughout the nation that are also doing great things, just to share the positive stories that are coming out of the reauthorization that happened in 2010, and really just pushing that forward. And it's been a wonderful collaboration for me to get new ideas. not only just share my ideas, but also take home some of those ideas that other districts are doing and being successful with and trying them with my kids.
We're talking with Amy Drogemeyer with U.S. School District 232 in DeSoto, Kansas, about instituting healthy food for kids in the schools. And how long have you been doing this personally, Amy? I mean, in your school district. Did you begin this when you started there?
There were some things that we had already started to implement when I took over, and we really just tried to roll them out gradually, but before they were part of the reauthorization. So things like whole grains, all the extra fruits and vegetables, we were already starting to push those out to our kids to get them used to it before it was required. This is my fifth year in the district and fifth year even doing this job, so it's new to me, but it's been a time of change, but I've only known change, which has, I think, been a benefit to us, is to be able to say, hey, this is the way it is, and we're going to be positive about it. We're going to do it because it's the right thing to do, and just give our kids that opportunity that they may not have outside of school.
Mm-hmm. Amy, can you talk a little bit more about that conversation with Congress when you, on your trip, when you went, what were the politicians saying, and did it give you any hope for prolonged and sustainable change?
Well, we met with Senator Roberts, who is our senator here in Kansas. He is the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, and that is where the reauthorization for 2016 is going through. That passed out of their committee unanimously with just some slight alterations to the 2010 reauthorization. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with that dialogue that we've been having, not just myself, but other districts in Kansas and throughout the United States about this is what's right for kids, and it is a government program. We are accepting government funding, so they have the right to make those rules, but doing it in line with the Dietary Guidelines for Americans and looking not just 5 years down the road or 10, but 20 and 30 years of what difference is this going to make in our society. Like I said, with health care and with healthy eating, the conversations on the Senate side were fantastic. They have moved forward. They are getting ready, hopefully, to send the bill to the floor. Then we have to wait on the House side. They're also in discussions. I met with Representative Yoder's staffer, and who I have a relationship with and have had some great conversations with. He represents us in the Kansas City area and is supporting, you know, the definite need to move forward with making sure our kids have what they need. We also talked a lot with them about making sure that the funding remained. It's not new funding. It's just continuing funding for some of those schools that are struggling or that do want to make changes but don't have the budget to do that. There are some grant monies that are allocated so far in the Senate bill that we're hoping to also see on the House side that will help some of those schools that need new equipment. Maybe their equipment is 20 or 30 years old and they need that to be able to offer healthier, fresh foods. So really just that general partnership. But we came away with a really great feeling that our representatives and our senators understand the great things we're doing in Kansas and across the nation in our schools because of our kids.
Yeah. Can you see, just as a part of a longer vision, that schools may also have their own vegetable grounds and fruit, just have their own gardens that help supply directly their food, and then just kind of making that a part of the learning process with the students?
That's definitely a push for school gardens and for salad bars. I know the salad bar dialogue was in the Senate bill about supporting that, how that's really helping schools be successful. But school gardens, we haven't done as much here just because seasonally it's hard to grow things except in the months when we're not in school. Mm-hmm. But I know some of my partners in Georgia have wonderful school gardens and programs in place. Because the kids are more likely to want to eat something they themselves have helped grow.
Yes.
And it teaches them where does their food come from so that they understand, you know, a potato grows underground or a blueberry grows on a bush. Mm-hmm. They don't just come from the grocery store. They don't just show up in a box. Mm-hmm. Really teaching them to be self-sustaining. And that's one of the things that I really feel like will help break the poverty cycle. We do have one Title I school in our district where our students are, more than 50% of our students are receiving free or reduced lunches. And so we have a need in this community, in some of our schools, for the kids to learn a lot of these skills so that they can be sustain themselves as they get older and have their own land and their own houses and families, and really be able to provide their families with fresh, local grown produce from their own backyards. Because we know that with the kids, when it's grown in your own backyard and you can take it and eat it, it tastes so much better than if you just bought it in the grocery store and it was harvested a week ago. Just getting them used to what's grown locally, and they're more likely to eat it because the flavor is so wonderful.
And was it a hard sell? Because I can imagine that getting federal money for a food program for the schools, it's going to cost more money to eat healthy. And they understand that and are willing to go along with that, meaning that they'll need to increase the funding.
Well, I know that is something that has been asked for. We are not sure that we're necessarily going to get the increased funding. That's why we're working on collaborative efforts to, if the funding doesn't come, what are ways that we as districts can support each other and can collaborate to cut costs in other areas or cut costs in production styles, those kinds of things, so that we can continue to offer the fresh fruits and vegetables, even if the funding doesn't come. And we know that there, you know, kind of is a gap there, but districts like mine, even without the funding, we're still able to be self-sustaining, meaning that we exist solely on the revenue that we generate in our cafeterias and are not taking any of that from our school's general fund or our taxpayer dollars. It's all of the federal monies or when the students choose to eat in our cafeterias. So we're looking for ways that even if the funding doesn't come, which I know is a difficult thing for with the budget and all of those things, to find extra money in today's U.S. budget, we're looking at ways that we can make no-cost or very low-cost changes in all of our schools to make everyone be successful.
I just had a thought. It's been a long time since I bought a school lunch. What's a week's worth of lunch tickets cost now? Or do you still do it like that?
Yeah, well, not tickets necessarily. The students in our district and in many districts, they have an opportunity to, it's almost like a debit card where you have money that's placed onto your account and you come through the line. And in our district, our students put in a keypad number that's assigned to them that goes to their particular lunch account their parents have put money into. And it just debits off every day. So we don't actually have tickets. Per se anymore. I remember that too growing up. It's $2.40 for a high school student to eat in our district, so times 5 days a week is about $12 or $13 a week for them to eat. And we offer them a phenomenal amount of choices under that amount of money.
And you're feeding the teenage boys too. Do they get to come back for seconds?
So yes, we are feeding the teenage boys too.
And, you know, I would like to say it's been a long time. It seems like my school lunches might have been about $2 for the whole week. I mean, it's really ridiculous because we're talking a few years back.
Right.
Now, you went to D.C. and you said you were with 100 people, peers, but the week before there'd been 900?
Yeah, this past week, there were other partners from the School Nutrition Association that also went to Capitol Hill. It's their annual visit, and we're advocating for the reauthorization and advocating for healthy meals, also advocating for more funding, which we all know would be beneficial to our programs. But again, that's not something we necessarily were asking for, but we definitely wanted to support the fact that this meal pattern does follow the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and we want to make sure that there's something that gets passed through Congress this year. We need to have that stability. It's National Nutrition Month, so we would love for Congress to pass it this month, but looking at moving forward and having some stability so that all of our operators can plan ahead and not worry about, are the guidelines going to change? Are they going to fluctuate? Really just creating a stable environment for all of us to play under.
So if someone out there listening is an activist, they could call their local representative, federal representative, or state senator and ask them to pass the reauthorization bill with the healthy foods package?
Yes. Yes, it's the Integrity Act. I'm not sure the full name of it, but that is the act that is coming out of the Senate Ag Committee on the Senate side. And I, like I said, I know that the House side is also working on a bill that we haven't seen the specifics of, but they've been we've been talking with them as well about the need to maintain these healthy standards for our students because they are making a difference in our schools.
And what's some of the feedback you've had from the children?
The kids, it's funny, the kids don't give me tons of feedback. They do in nonverbal ways sometimes. Mm-hmm. Their participation is great. We are selling lots of meals. We've actually increased since the regulations have changed. But it's the parents that I hear from, and I live in the same community that I work in, and they're my kids' friends' parents. And the things that I'm hearing are, I can't believe my kid will eat broccoli. I can't believe my kid eats sweet potatoes. I can't believe my kid eats kumquat. Things like that that we are offering that parents may have tried to offer at home. I get asked, how do you make that? Because my kid says it's awesome at school and I can't do it like you. Things like that where nice. We're just really coming alongside parents trying to help them. They all want to make the right choices for their children. And we're just trying to help give them another environment where maybe that positive peer pressure is helping them make the right choices and then taking that home. And it's more the feedback from the parents about we're very proud of what's offered here. We're very proud of the things that my child has access to every day.
Well, our guest today has been Amy Drogemeyer with U.S. School District 232 in DeSoto, Kansas. Thank you so much, Amy, for taking the time to be interviewed by us today on Every Woman and sharing this positive story with our listeners.
You're very welcome. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you, and best wishes with your efforts in a great, nutritious school year.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Every Woman. Please join us again next Saturday at 3 o'clock Central Standard Time, and we'll talk more about women in history. And please stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf. And after that, guess who's coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.